This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, host of The Takeout, joined as I am every week by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS News. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
You know, Steve, sometimes I wonder if the big overlords in New York like it when I say, welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I think they sort of get annoyed by that, don't you think?
Oh, well, you might have to get that written in your next contract.
I think so. I don't mean I don't like my regular job. I love my regular job, chief White House correspondent for CBS News. But I love spending time with you, our devoted and cherished listeners to this podcast and viewers. There you are on CBSN. I love hanging out with you. That's why it's the very best part of my broadcast week. And hanging out with Shigaris. That's always a cool thing. So, overlords, cool it on that. It's okay.
It's all good.
You know, overlords.
It comes from a good place.
Overlords, they can get a little angst-ridden at times. You know what
I mean? Have you gotten emails on it?
There's just a vibe sometimes. There's just a vibe. Yeah. Kind of makes me nervous, you know? Try to get rid of the nervous vibe. Our guest this week for this episode of The Takeout is Tim Phillips, the president of Americans for Prosperity. Wow, what a wonderful sounding name that is.
Who's against that? I want to know who's against that.
Who's not for America and who's not for prosperity?
Those darn liberals, they're not for it.
Here we go.
Hold on.
Nice segue.
Wait a minute. Steve, good to see you.
Wait a minute. Wow, the gentility out the window.
We haven't even ordered lunch yet.
No,
what's going on? Hold on.
We will order lunch. We're at Riss, one of the restaurants that we have frequented before. It's in the west end of Washington, D.C., if you know that geography, just a little bit south of DuPont Circle. We're delighted that they are our host this week, so thankful to be here with them. So, Tim, I'm going to just give you an open forum for a second. What is Americans for Prosperity?
We're a grassroots group that focuses on bringing prosperity, there you go, that word, and genuinely helping every American live the American dream. And we think a couple of foundational aspects are needed to achieve the dream. One is economic freedom. And the other one is individual liberty. And the two kind of work hand in hand. So we seek policies at the state, local, federal level that can achieve those. And we do work on a state-based model. So we have full-time staff in 36 states across the country. Some of them are red states, you know, South Carolina maybe, or Tennessee. Others are blue states. Illinois is an example. And then swing states like Ohio, Florida, Colorado, Nevada, places like that. And we've been on the ground doing this now for almost 13 years, which is hard to believe, about 13 years now.
Some will say you buried the lead on who's we.
Well, David Koch is the foundation chairman, and Charles is a supporter as well. We're proud to have the Koch brothers, as folks like to call them, their support, absolutely.
And we're going to get into this in somewhat more detail, but you know the allegation, dark money, that this is undisclosed, that it is billionaires reshaping and, to the mind of your critics, warping the American political process. Address that from your point of view.
It's the First Amendment right to free speech. That can be anonymous speech as well, which means you can protect the identity of your donors. Given what the climate out there, sadly, the decorum that has been lost, and sometimes on both sides, this isn't meant as a partisan statement, I think it's good to protect individual financial supporters if they would like us to, and we do that. And it is First Amendment right that we're talking about here. To free speech. And again, that's anonymous. I mean, Thomas Jefferson was doing anonymous speech back during his campaigns. So was John Adams, using newspapers and other supporters out there. This is a long, tried and true American tradition of free speech and sometimes anonymous speech.
I want to give a chance to one of the Koch brothers to address this, because our colleague at CBS, Anthony Mason, sat down with Charles Koch at his home in Wichita, October 11th, 2015. This was on CBS Sunday Morning. It's an extended clip where we kind of go through this. Arden, please run that.
A lot of our donors don't want to take the kind of abuse that I do. They don't want these attacks. They don't want the death threats. So they aren't going to participate if they have to have their names associated with it.
But do you think it's healthy for the system that so much money is coming out of a relatively small group of people?
Well, listen, if I didn't think it was healthy or fair, I wouldn't do it. Because what we're after is to fight against special interests.
Well, some people would look at you and say you're a special interest.
Yeah, but my interest is just as it's been in business. is what will help people improve their lives and to get rid of these special interests. That's the whole thing that drives me.
There are people out there who think what you're trying to do is essentially buy power.
But I don't... What I want is a system where there isn't as much centralized power.
Isn't as much centralized power. How do you define that, Tim Phillips? I know AFP, Americans for Prosperity, is against labor unions, for example. Is that a seat of centralized power you would like to see less influential in American politics?
Our goal would be to have government less often choosing winners and losers in the marketplace. And government does that, and it's leading to a two-tiered society where the people who have good lobbyists, a lot of money, connections, or power are getting benefits. I think about tax reform right now, and what we're calling for is a level, lower, flatter rates across the board and carving out, getting rid of these 45,000-plus special interest deductions in the code for everyone.
Some
and that's what we mean by that. Absolutely. Get rid of them. For energy, get rid of them. Look, they don't need it. They don't. And wind and solar doesn't deserve it. You shouldn't be propping up an industry that's struggled. But you also shouldn't give benefits, bennies, to a very wealthy industry like the like big oil. Get rid of it. Let's have lower, flatter rates across the board. Let's collapse the individual rates. There are seven of them down to three or four. You have lower, flatter rates across the board. And so when we say we're actually against special interests, that's what we mean. Let's have government choosing winners and losers far less often, because inevitably it leads to a two-tiered society where you have those who have real lobbyists, real power, doing pretty darn well.
When you say a two-tiered society, it sounds to me as if you're saying part of this income separation that we've seen in America is driven by things you are fighting against. You
part
sound like a kind of a populist.
I'm
in that
glad.
Respect.
No, not a populist. I'm glad we're sitting all sitting down here, getting ready to have some food, because we agree with Bernie Sanders on this. Income inequality, it is leading to a two-tiered society. There's no question about that. The question is, what do you do about it to bring back a stronger American dream where everyone can rise up? And we would argue that one key element of that is eliminating a lot of the benefits and special interest carve-outs that help every single group out there. And that's what we're about. That's one of the areas we agree with Sanders and the far left on the problem. Obviously, the solution to the problem is different there, Major.
Speaking of Bernie Sanders, he sat down with another one of our CBS colleagues, Charlie Rose, November 14th, 2014. Arden, please.
The Republican Party is largely funded by the Koch brothers and a few other billionaires. Do you know what the Koch brothers believe? You should have them up here sometime. I don't know if you ever have. They don't want to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Not the Koch brothers. They want to eliminate those programs. They want to eliminate public education in America. This is an extreme right-wing group that spends hundreds of millions of dollars to elect Republicans. And they now have an enormous influence over the Republican
Party. But they weren't supportive of Donald Trump.
Oh, I think they will be just fine with Mr. Trump.
So address that, if you will.
We hold Republicans accountable all the time. In fact, we opposed the initial health care effort from the House. It didn't do what they promised to do for four consecutive election cycles when the House Republicans and the Senate said, we're going to put this law where it belongs on the ash heap of history. We're going to fully repeal it. They didn't talk about nibbling around the edge. They didn't do it. And we opposed it. We fought them tooth and nail on it. Right now, at the state level, we consistently oppose them when they try to raise taxes or raise spending. Sometimes we're successful in stopping a gas tax, for example, in Louisiana just 2 weeks ago. Sometimes we lose. In Kansas, the home state of Cook, we just had a tough setback there where they raised taxes across the board. Republicans, not Democrats.
So, overriding the veto of Governor Sam Brownback.
Yes, so we lose occasionally, but we hold Republicans accountable. We're not an appendage of the Republican Party. We sat out the presidential. In 2008, we sat it out. It wasn't just a Trump thing. We looked at John McCain and Barack Obama in 08. They were both for cap and trade. Remember those days? Mm-hmm. Cap and trade's now dead, and the left's got problems on the environmental front because they went so extreme. But back then, you had the major party nominees of both parties for cap and trade. We set it out. So 12, we got involved. We thought there was a wide philosophical gulf. We got involved against Barack Obama, and this past time we didn't. So we're 1-3. We're active in one of the last three presidentials. So if we're a party appendage, like Bernie Sanders says, and he's a joke on this, by the way, then we're a pretty poor one because we set out two of the last three presidential races. Kelly Ayotte, by the way, in New Hampshire, ask her if we don't sit out races sometimes. We do. If those guys are philosophically going the wrong way, we're not beholden those guys.
Kelly Ayotte, for those in our audience who may not know, ran for re-election in New Hampshire, lost,
And I gather you're suggesting that if you'd been in there, she might have won.
I don't know. I'm just saying we set out that race. We were not involved. We were involved with Marco Rubio in Florida. We were involved with Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. We didn't win everywhere we were involved. We were involved in Nevada.
But those two you did win, or they, those two candidates did win.
Yeah, we were involved in Nevada. That was a bitter setback. We would love to have, you know, seen Harry Reid's seat go to someone from the other side philosophically. That was a tough loss, but we were involved there. So we go where we see a significant policy difference. And where we think we can make a difference.
You mentioned lunch a moment ago. It's time to order.
Oh,
Russell,
absolutely.
Our outstanding waiter here at Riss is ready to take our order. And because you are our guest, Tim, order up first, please.
I'm going cheeseburger with, do you have cheddar cheese?
Yes, we do.
Cheddar cheese. And do you have French fries?
Uh-huh.
French fries.
And how should the meat be cooked?
Medium rare.
Russell, chicken Milanese for me would be great.
Steak frites, please. Medium.
Mm-hmm. Medium? What?
Just medium.
Oh, okay.
Just medium. We'll discuss that during
the
break.
We'll save
the
plus for segment two. You're listening to The Takeout.
The House has passed a bill, and now the Senate is working very, very hard, and specifically the folks in this room, and I really appreciate what you're doing, to come out with a bill that's going to be a phenomenal bill for the people of our country. Generous, kind, with heart. That's what I'm saying. And that may be adding additional money into it. We're going to come out with a real bill, not Obamacare. And the results are going to be fantastic, and hopefully it'll be announced at the appropriate time, and everyone's going to be happy.
That's the voice of the 45th President of the United States, Donald Trump, talking about Senate deliberations, all in secret so far, about a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Tim Phillips, our guest this week for The Takeout. He is the President of Americans for Prosperity. You mentioned in segment one some differences that your group has had with House Republicans. When you hear the President say generous, kind, with heart, and they may be adding additional money to the House bill, how do you react to that?
Well, certainly we're kind and generous as well on the free market side. And we know that when you're stuck in Medicaid, which 74 million Americans now are, you're not getting generous health care actual treatment. You're getting lousy treatment compared to folks who have private insurance.
So but does that language make you nervous about where the Senate debate's headed?
And what do you think it means?
We're concerned about the direction of health care. We wanted them. And maybe we were naive, Major. Maybe we were just naive. But we thought when you promised in four consecutive election cycles, 10, 12, 14, 16, cycles that went pretty well, yet the party has the best situation since the 1920s and the Coolidge era. We thought maybe that would be the time to keep your word. Maybe, again, we were naive, I guess. They didn't do it. That was disappointing, deeply disappointing. To millions of Americans, I was just with some in Georgia 6 who were disappointed.
When you say they didn't, you mean the House bill?
The House and Senate did not.
Right.
It got better in the second iteration in the House. I know CW says that the Senate's going to make it even more moderate. I know that's normally how it works. I get it. But this has been a year where the unexpected happens, it seems like, every 3 or 4 days or so. So we're still hopeful on the Senate front. We're pushing them. And what we're telling Republicans is this. If you pass something, you're going to own it. With the American people, you're going to own it. So for goodness sakes, make sure it's worth the trouble. In other words, make sure it goes far enough in dismantling a law that hurts millions of Americans. Make the case, change it enough that you're really going to help people. And we're concerned that it might not. That's the big concern we have. We want to actually help people have better health care coverage or an actual the actual treatment they receive.
So the margins in the House, a wider margin of a majority for the Republicans, and they had trouble getting something through. You saw what they did.
By one vote.
What are you anticipating from the Senate, which is a much, much smaller margin?
Mitch McConnell over the years have had differences on some issues with him. He is a consummate leader within that institution. He knows what he's doing in a significant way. It would not be at all surprising to see him get to 50 votes. We are urging them to go big with this, though. And to not nibble around the edges and to not keep adding back in money, which in reality is just more subsidies, more government stuff that doesn't really take care of people. That's the admonition we're giving to the Senate. But I would never underestimate Mitch McConnell's ability to actually get something through the Senate. He is a consummate tactician for moments like this.
And I made reference to this a moment ago. I think this is important because I watched very carefully the debate in Congress and the Obama administration's approach to drafting and passing the Affordable Care Act. And it was, in many respects, unprecedented. A lot of procedural furniture was broken in both the House and the Senate to make that a bill that became a law.
Right.
Even so,
like what's, if you what is a tax or not a tax?
Right.
Because I mean, it was the court.
Lots of different changes in terminology, interpretation, and rules were strained in the Senate to make it possible. And there was a lot of arm twisting in the House. But compared to this process, certainly in the Senate, it was more open and visible. As someone who believes in these ideas, believes and criticizes the Obamacare process for being too secretive, how can you be comfortable with a process that nobody, not even you, can see right now in terms of drafting this?
I would argue that the House process was actually a relatively public process.
It was, but the Senate one has not been.
Yeah, but they have a roadmap from which to go on with the House bill. So they're not operating out of whole cloth, we don't think. I mean, they could always go back and just have their brand new thing. But
well, you talked to a lot of Senate Republicans. They're essentially talking about redrafting this bill in many significant ways.
Yeah, we're concerned. And we have been deeply disappointed so far.
Right, it's a roadmap that you don't even agree with, right? So
it got better. The first iteration was terrible, and then the second one, we moved from opposition to neutral on it. It was better, but sometimes the simple in politics, which Clausewitz said the simple is most important in warfare, but the simple is very difficult to execute. Sometimes, sometimes the simple thing to do, just go big. The American people
define that.
Actually, roll back Obamacare. Actually do that, and don't worry about having a bunch of subsidies in there. And tax credits are subsidies. You change the name from the Obamacare subsidy to tax credits. You think, oh, well, that's okay because it's free market now. So, no, it's not. Not really. And so the other thing is all of the mandates in Obamacare that tell you if you're 28 years old and you're a male and you're relatively healthy, you're going to pay double or triple what you really should have to pay because of these essential mandates that are in Obamacare. We're going to get rid of those. That's the kind of change that is worth doing.
But what do you say to these Republicans who are going home and getting hammered in moderate districts and districts that might be battleground districts next year, who are getting hammered on the Obamacare question? They are fearful of that repeal, repeal.
Forgive us if we don't have a lot of sympathy. You win four consecutive national elections. Even when you lost the presidency in 12, you were just fine in the House and in the Senate. In the House. You were just fine. And you didn't lose seats, really, to speak of in the Senate. Just forgive us for not having sympathy. You won four straight elections.
On this promise.
If you ask a group of swing voters in any district in the country, hey, what's the number one promise Republicans have made over the last 7-8 years? They'll tell you, and it's unambiguous, oh, get rid of Obamacare. They said they're going to do that. If you ask base conservatives, base Republicans, what's the number one promise of these guys in the House? Not Trump as much, but the House and the Senate, which is why they bear, frankly, more of a burden of responsibility than the president does on this one, because they promised it in four straight elections.
Long before he was on the scene.
That's why we focus more on the House and Senate here, because they promised it all these years, unambiguously. I mean, how many guys, Major, you're on the road. Steve, you're on the road a lot. You heard these guys.
Mm-hmm.
It was unflinching.
And gals.
Guys is general neutral in my sense. But it was unflinching. We're going to put this law on the ash heap of history. We're going to repeal it. And just do it. And we were naive on it. We're still pushing them now. And something is better than nothing. We're not walking away. We're flatly not walking away. It's too important to do something on this.
I've heard people describe this as an existential question politically for Republicans. If you don't do this, you risk losing base supporters in ways you haven't even begun to anticipate. Do you think that's true?
They have enormous problems if they don't do this. I'm on the road all the time. I was in Georgia 6 2 days ago. You and I were talking before we started here. Talking to our activists and then also to kind of rank and file conservatives at the doors with our teams there. And it is an expectation that is almost, they assume it's a fait accompli. Oh, of course they're going to do that. It's not like tax reform where they go, well, boy, that's not, even, you know, the average.
That'd be great if that happened.
That's a big one. Wow, that's, I hope it happens because it'll get us going. But when you ask them about health care, it's a fait accompli, they assume. That's a much different expectation. And what you hear sometimes at doors is, if they can't do that, and they've talked about it for, 7-8 years, dogs chase cats. If Republicans can't get Obamacare rollback, what's the point, kind of? So the expectations are high for them. We're still hopeful, and we're not walking away. We are deeply concerned, though.
concern.
And they've missed a chance. They could have moved quickly here. Day one, the House could have done this. They could have gone back to the Price blueprint, which, you know,
Who's now head of HHS, was a member of the
House Republican leadership. The only Obamacare repeal that actually made it to the president's desk, and y'all remember this, was the Price plan. And it actually made it to the House and Senate to their credit. And our point was, just go back to that. It wasn't perfect, but nothing is. Just go back to what you voted for through both chambers. And they didn't, and it was deeply disappointing. We're still hopeful.
Because they were basically giving you the impression that was a phony vote, because they knew he would veto it and it wouldn't be real.
Well, what's the – right. If you voted for it then, 88% of House Republicans today voted to repeal Obamacare. 88%. Almost 9 out of 10. So what's different? And most of the Senate Republicans did. The numbers were not quite as high, a little bit more turnover. But what's different? Surely those were not show votes. We hope they weren't. But why not just go back and do it? And it was disappointing. And you know, there are friends that you respect, and we respect Paul Ryan. I have a lot of respect for him. We've known him for well over almost 20 years now. And we disagree deeply. It doesn't mean we're working together on other real issues, but it is disappointing. And they can still fix it. They can still roll this law back in a substantial fashion. So we're not walking away. We are disappointed, but we're not walking away from this. I want to make sure that's coming through, because we're not. It's not. We've not moved on. This can still get done.
That's the voice of Tim Phillips, president of Americans for Prosperity. I am with Steve Shigaris. You are listening to The Takeout.
Listening to The Takeout.
Welcome back. I'm Major Garrett, joined as I am every week by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS News. Our guest this week, Tim Phillips, president of Americans for Prosperity, born in South Carolina. Both parents, I'm told, blue-collar Democratic populists. Grandfather, active in the Democratic machine.
Very much so.
Your father, named Franklin Delano Phillips.
That's right. He was born in 34. Franklin little Frankie, Franken Delvo. Absolutely.
How great is that?
Absolutely.
I have a note that says here, parents were greatly concerned with young Tim's interest in Ronald Reagan.
True story. We were watching Walter, my mom was the 4 to midnight shift, so my dad and I would watch Walter Cronkite. He drove a bus, but
he worked for a really important news network, I remember.
That's right. Well, we were watching Walter.
Yes, CBS.
So we're watching one night, and I'll never forget this. I'm like 13 or 14, but we were a political family. We were active in blue-collar politics and our Democrat machine politics. And Cronkite's on, and this guy comes on talking about the Panama Canal of all issues, which I knew what it was because we followed this stuff. And the guy talked, and he made sense, and I looked at my dad when the segment was over, and Cronkite went to commercial, and I go, Dad, I'm going to be for that guy. That guy's incredible. My dad, now Steve's young. He won't remember this, Major.
Right.
He did something very unusual in our house. There were no remotes back then.
Right.
He got up off the couch and turned off Walter Cronkite. That did not happen. He said, son, that man is for the rich man. And he's running against Jimmy Carter, who happens to be a Southerner, a Southern Baptist,
right,
which we were.
Born again.
Absolutely. And still am. And a Democrat. You will not be voting for him. And I go, all the same, I'm going to be for him. And so there was no Republican Party in South Carolina, not really at the time.
Right.
This was 78, 79. But I got active at my high school. There was a Reagan thing, and I volunteered for Reagan in 80. And I was hooked. I did an internship 84 in the Reagan administration in 1984. And I was hooked, Major. And it really was. It was Reagan for me. And all these years later, it still remains true.
Interesting. We're going to get into...
By the way, Franklin Delano
did
end up voting for his first Republican in 2000. I was working with George W. Bush's campaign as a... Ralph Reed and I were consultants and vendors of the campaign.
Direct mail and other things, right?
Yeah, and South Carolina was one of our key states.
Absolutely.
I'm a South Carolina native, Ralph, a Southerner. And
that's
we're
just ask John McCain about that.
Well, and stop. And McCain had won New Hampshire.
Yes,
and so we're on the ropes. And so finally I go to my mom and dad and I go, guys, look, little Timbo here, because I was the youngest kid, little Timbo... I may not have a job in 2 weeks or a client. Can you please vote for this guy? And they did. Mom and Dad voted for their first Republican. Mom was youngest of 12 kids. She turned a bunch of her family out. Anyway, so they broke that year.
Timbo.
There you go. I think
for the rest of the podcast.
That was probably a mistake.
Right.
I think that was a tactical error.
We'll get back to that in just a second, Timbo. But for those of us watching us on CBSN and listening, you know, we've got these really cool cool items for the podcast. The only real cool item we have, other than me and Steve, Takeout Podcast stickers. With this illegible, CBSN, illegible signature of mine.
You want one?
As I said,
you know how to get one?
In earlier episodes, the closest I will ever be to a physician in America is having an illegible signature like this one.
Bing, 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 bing.
Thank you, Mr. President. Steve,
you know how to get one.
Give us the statistics. I'll tell you how to get one. On how many people have written, because, Tim, well, I want you to know you'll appreciate this because you're a man of a certain age, as am I.
Yes.
You cannot receive a Takeout Podcast sticker if you ask us via text, Facebook, Twitter, or email. You cannot. We will not accept any electronic requests.
There's
only
snail mail?
One way.
Oh, yes.
Self-addressed stamped envelopes.
Love it. Love it. Love it.
153 people to date have sent us self-addressed stamped envelopes.
Talk about grassroots
that
activism.
That is grassroots. CBS News is right. Grassroots activism, you guys.
39 states, the district, and six foreign countries.
Yes. And 39 states in this great republic.
Steve, aren't most countries foreign? I'm pretty sure they are.
Hold on.
That is true.
I think they are.
Seven countries, six of them foreign.
That's right.
Six of them not called the United States of America.
There's only one way to do that, as we said.
What is the way, Steve?
Well, if you'd like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20036.
All right, back to the news. As some of you in our cherished audience may remember or maybe learning for the first time, for two very blessed years of my journalistic career, I worked for National Journal before I came to CBS. Before I got to National Journal in 2011, that distinguished publication wrote an article in which it interviewed you about the question and the politics of climate change. And you said, and I quote you directly, "We've made great headway. What it means for candidates on the Republican side is if you buy into green energy or you play footsie on this issue, you do so at your political peril. The vast majority of people who are involved in the Republican nominating process, the conventions, and the primaries are suspect of the science. And that's our influence." You were speaking, I believe, of Americans for Prosperity. Groups like American Prosperity have done it. Are you proud of that?
We are certainly glad that the focus has been on the policies that the environmental left wants to do to Americans in the name of global warming. And we focus on that relentlessly, starting with cap and trade. Over a decade ago, Major, you were covering that. Mm-hmm. This was a long, multi-year battle. And the focus for us has been, here's what they want to do to you in the name of global warming, and here's what it means for you. And we broke it down to six words. Higher taxes, lost jobs, less freedom. Those were the six words we focused on. That would have been the outcome of the left's policies with cap and trade. And we are glad that law is that never became
the bill,
a reality.
Right.
Or that bill never became a reality. And, Major, you look at the issues that we're having repealing Obamacare, and then you look at the success, and we give Trump credit for this. They are rolling back, whether it's Clean Power Plant, these onerous rules that would have driven up utility bills and killed jobs, whether it's that, whether it's some of the waterways of the U.S. Regs that are out there, we're seeing progress. And one reason, thank you very much.
Make way for lunch.
That looks fabulous, by the way.
Make way for lunch.
One reason we're seeing enormous progress, and good for the Trump administration on this front, is that you're not trying to repeal a law. And the reason you're not trying to repeal a law is because the royal we and our network was involved, but others as well. We were able to stop cap and trade. And most of the other elements of the legislative agenda of the environmental left.
Tim, one of the things we like to do on this podcast, and I try to strive to do, is help our listeners and viewers work with and feel comfortable with the language we exchange in Washington all the time,
right?
But they may not know. They may not understand. Summarize cap and trade, what it is, and then why you were against it.
Cap and trade would have regulated CO2 emissions, you know, carbon, basically.
Carbon, right.
And it would have had the government establish a government-run market that would have forced individual American, you know, businesses to purchase the rights on this market, which was, again, a government market, to be productive, to actually use the energy that you need for the pursuit of your business.
And the idea was, if I understand it correctly, was to create a taxing structure for carbon the more carbon you pollute, the higher your taxes. The theory is if you become more efficient and less polluting, you can take these credits and sell them. And there was this idea proposed that that was kind of a free market way to deal with the regulation. I see the look on your face. I'm gathering you did not buy that at all.
A free market way that has a government-established market that lets government dictate the cost of a really important product, you know, which is the key to our energy production, which almost every job depends on energy, and whether it's the company or whether it's the individual American jumping in a car or truck and driving to the job. It would have been far less freedom for Americans. And the goal, and look, the left was clear about this, and so was the President Obama, to his credit. He said, we want higher energy prices. If you're in coal or oil, we want you paying a higher price because we want to incentivize the kind of energy we like, wind, solar, etc. The problem with doing that, and the left still does this, and a lot of Republicans do, Major, and this is maddening to us, they subsidize these favored industries, back to a point we made earlier. You have about $4 billion in taxpayer money every year going to wind and solar. And imagine if you told Apple, hey, no matter what, no matter how good or bad the iPhone is, we're going to let you have 50% market share. Do you think the Apple iPhone would be better and productive and more efficient and more innovative every year? Of course not. They would have guaranteed market share. Yet cap and trade and other laws also guarantee market share. They say to utility companies, 20, 30, 40, 50% of your energy production for your citizens have to come from this green energy. What does that mean? It means they have guaranteed market share. They're never going to get more efficient. And wind and solar is not getting more efficient because of that. And it saddles individual Americans, that single mom out there trying to raise a couple of kids, with higher utility bills if the left gets their way. That's what we mean by the policies.
So in the wake of the Paris climate change debate, people pro-environment people were saying that the real jobs are going to be in these, as you call them, favored industries, wind and solar. And, you know, this is a jobs program, actually, and this is good for jobs. If the president is talking about creating jobs, this is a place where he should go, and pulling out of the climate agreement halts that. What is your reaction to that?
Government choosing or picking winners and losers and saying, we're going to let you create jobs in this area with our taxpayer money, it never works. It leads to corruption, to cronyism. We saw the Solyndra, which was the infamous hundreds of millions of dollars money taken away. It leads to corruption and cronyism when you have government choosing winners and losers, which is what they've done with wind and solar. And Republicans have been guilty of this as well. When you mentioned the National Journal article earlier, we are glad, and we did make a concerted effort for years to hold Republicans accountable, to tell them, look, there is no freebie here. The days of sounding, you know, warm and fuzzy on the campaign trail by promising to favor certain industries over others in pursuit of, you know, political gain, we're going to hold you accountable for that. And we did, and it's changed. And the Republican Party is much better now.
But some of our audience might say, wait a minute, you're making this the greatest, most safest economic environment for oil and natural gas that it's ever been.
What we're saying is, let's reward the best kind of energy production, whatever it is, fracking right now, hydraulic fracturing. If the left had its way, it would be gone. They've been open about this too, by the way. Let's end it. We don't like it for ideological reasons. They would have destroyed one of the job-producing behemoths of the last decade, one of the few sectors of our economy that's been booming and going and growing and creating prosperity. It's allowed American manufacturing, to an extent, to come back because now, natural gas is cheaper, and we have lower energy costs than much of the rest of the world now. So thank goodness for these guys innovating, and they had a bullseye on them backs politically.
They argue it's killing the environment, right? They're saying that the right doesn't care about the environment.
Prove it. It's not true. We have the cleanest air and cleanest water we've had, and we want clean air and clean water. We've looked at China, where you have runaway, a lack of any kind of basic environmental rule of law. It's not good for people. So we've absolutely
valued
that.
Yeah, but there's clean air
that.
And clean water because there are federal laws about that.
Absolutely. And we don't oppose
those. And conservatives opposed, because I was there. It was one of the first legislative battles I ever covered when George H.W. Bush went to reauthorize the Clean Air Act. Hardline conservatives were dead set against him. He cut that deal with moderate Republicans and Democrats.
Clean air and clean water, it's the best we've had in generations. No one's arguing that. No one's seriously arguing that anymore. You have, and so that's protected, and we want to protect that. What we're saying, what they want to us in the name of global warming, is not really, in a demonstrable way, improving the environment. And it's killing jobs. It's driving up gas bills, utility bills. And it hurts Americans, actual individual Americans. That's what we're talking about. And the environmental movement's become one of the most elitist movements I've ever seen. It changed from 25 years ago, Major. These guys on the other side, guys, gals, again, gender neutral term, they are. They're elitist now. They go out and they fly in their private jets, whether it's Leonardo DiCaprio or others, and I like some of his movies, but and they tell every other American, hey, you need to live on less. You need to do less. Now, we're important, so we're going to have private jets and yachts and all this stuff, but we're important. You need to live on less. And it's not selling. We're better off now than we were 12, 15 years ago. And I tell conservative audiences out there who are down and frustrated sometimes, can we really turn this around? What I say to them is go back 15 years to when Al Gore was winning his awards for The Inconvenient Truth, which was debunked for the most part, or whether it's Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich at the time sitting on that couch for the infamous thing about climate change, or whether it was cap and trade being supported by the nominees of both major parties in 08, McCain and Obama. Today we're making progress, and we're making progress because we focused on the impact on individual Americans of these environmental extreme policies if they had their way in the name of global warming. That's what we're doing.
I let you go, did you make simply political progress at the expense of science?
Absolutely not. No. We made progress by shining a light, finally, on the implications on the daily lives of Americans, of their policies. I think that's been the key for us. The policy prescriptions the left has, they hurt people, and they hurt the poor and people who are struggling at the margins the most. And that is a problem for the environmental left. They haven't fixed yet because their policies hurt average folks.
That's Tim Phillips, president of Americans for Prosperity, our guest at the Takeout. We have been and are going to continue, I promise you.
This looks fabulous, by the way.
Enjoying lunch here at Riss Restaurant in the West End of Washington, D.C. If you care about grassroots activism in American politics, and if you're listening to the show, you probably have some interest in that. Tim Phillips is somebody you need to be aware of, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to him. Tim, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You've been listening to, and of course, Steve Chigaris, thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure.
The political director of CBS. I think you know this, but I'm just going to tell you before we leave, you've been listening to The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, Katiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.